Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
All right. Thank you very much, Audrey. No, we're not laughing at you. I was laughing at Mike. He passed on the word to me that pretty soon, when Johnny Cash gets picked up by that trucker in our opening song, he'll be asking me for gas money. I can certainly believe that. If you've been listening to talk radio lately and hear some of these truckers calling in, they're saying they're losing 20-30%, or making 20-30% less than they were last year, when gas prices were down like 70% from what they are. What they are now. But this is the Jumble Justice Radio Show, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Keith Haley. You're on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we want to thank Johnny Cash again for taking us on that expensive trip across the country. You know, I got some advice and a very fine marketing newsletter now that Blog Talk Radio has started, and written by, very well written, a very fine gentleman. He says we should only play our opening music for about 15 seconds. Well, heavens, he can't understand the temptation that Hillbilly has to play that whole song. So we have to make it at least to Dayton, Ohio, a place that is fond in my heart, having been a police officer there back in the Ice Age. Emily, Mike, thanks for being in the room tonight. And Emily, I guess you're going to help us with some news tonight, which I appreciate very much. The purpose of our show, ladies and gentlemen, real quick, is to discuss news issues, events, and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Tonight's show will be a little bit of a diversion off, but I think some folks that might have an interest in writing and publishing will certainly pick up on this, and those that just need a little background information on some things past and some new directions in the publishing field might enjoy this tonight. But our show is dedicated to those energetic and tireless police, courts, corrections, and criminal justice, juvenile justice officials and professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed the world. And I've got news articles tonight, I don't know if I'll get to them, about U.S. police officials being trained to serve overseas in various kinds of assignments. So it's not that unusual anymore, or even local police officers, at least some of them, are doing some time overseas. What we try to do in this show is look inside criminal justice practice and its professionals, and tonight we'll make a little exception to that and talk about some writing and publication in the field. Blog Talk Radio, as you know by now, is certainly a leading-edge technology that delivers these shows. We're now up to the point where I think there are now 100,000 shows archived on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And just go to BTR if you've never done that, blogtalkradio.com, and look at some of the shows and the list of shows, some very popular with folks you'll recognize from media, from entertainment, from the news field, significant authors, entrepreneurs, on and on and on. So what's possible in this medium now, which is one of the top 100 websites in the world in terms of popularity, that's right along with Google, Facebook, YouTube, things like that, any person in the interest group in the organization, I'm fond of saying, from cigars to astronomy, from darts to homicide investigation, can have their own show. They can broadcast live and streaming audio worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. Yes, and it's absolutely free. You can't beat that. So, you know, I'm not sure if blog talk radio is the right term for this anymore, but I suspect there's no name change in the offing here. So you can get your own show, which would be very good. What we're going to do tonight is talk about something that is of interest to me and some folks that work in the various levels of higher education and criminal justice. And we're going to talk about criminal justice publishing. We're going to call it a fork in the road for authors, faculty, and students. And, of course, the emphasis here will be on what's happening in terms of digital media, books, magazines, journals, and also audiobooks, which are becoming very popular. If you go to some store like Books A Million, which I'm really liking, I don't know if you ever have a chance to go to a Books A Million store, but I just like the way they're set up, the openness there. And, of course, there's always a little cafe to get a coffee or juice or whatever you're looking for. But that's what we're going to talk about tonight. And this field is really changing. And, of course, you're seeing cross purposes here or multiple missions on the part of people like Amazon, for example, which I'm very fond of. It's a company that will send you things virtually all over the world. And when they say they're going to deliver by a certain date, it's certainly there. But you have a company like Amazon that's now deep in the publishing business. Before, they just sold books, and I'll talk more about that later on. What you do as a listener or a caller, you can call in right now. You can contact the host. There's a button right on the radio site or on the website where you don't even have to use your cell phone anymore, unless you want to, of course. And you can call right into the host of any of these Blog Talk Radio shows, which is a significant improvement. This is going to allow people literally from all over the world to call in without the expense of a cell phone or a landline phone call. Well, you know what we always do. We always start with a blonde joke, and Audrey's got one tonight that's all in tune with what everybody's raging about lately is fitness and health and condition and body weight. So, Audrey, why don't you go ahead with this joke tonight about a blonde losing some weight. I will point out that Audrey is a blonde, a longtime collector of blonde jokes, and she sees no offense in these jokes. Let's have it, Audrey.
Professor Haley, this is a snappy blonde joke tonight that fits in with the weight-conscious times we live in. Here it is. A blonde is overweight, so her doctor puts her on a diet. I want you to eat regularly for 2 days, then skip a day, and repeat the procedure for 2 weeks. The next time I see you, you'll have lost at least 5 pounds. When the blonde returns, she's lost nearly 20 pounds. Why, that's amazing, the doctor says. Did you follow my instructions? The blonde nods. I'll tell you, though. I thought I was going to drop dead that third day. From hunger, you mean, said the doctor. No, from skipping, replied the blonde.
She skipped everything. Oh, I like that one. I know another place I can use that. That's a good one. Thank you, Audrey. And ladies and gentlemen, a much more serious note. In the wake of the Supreme Court's decision a couple of weeks ago that we all have a right to possess firearms, let's be sure about it that we're not talking about criminals. So the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence has prepared a public service announcement that we've been broadcasting for maybe at least 2 years. And this is an announcement to the criminals on the street to lay down their guns and see the senselessness of gun violence. So we're going to play that in the interest of public service.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. a message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Ohio Coalition, we certainly appreciate your work, and it is a deadly idea. It's a terrible thing that's happened when criminals choose firearms and go out and commit crime. So we hope they'll hear that announcement and go turn in their weapons. Mike, you're not sure? I think it is directed toward the criminals, not the law-abiding citizen. Certainly not. Well, let me warm up tonight on the news with some interesting things going on. And as you know, we've done a couple shows on criminal justice going green, and there's no limit to what is possible to save energy in the field of criminal justice. I'm just looking around some articles here this past week, and I see state troopers aren't allowed to gas up their cars in one state anymore at the state pumps. They used to get sort of a reduced rate, I guess. They can't do that. Some agencies are actually being encouraged to sit a little more as opposed to go out and engage in random patrol. I think that would be a major drawback, don't you? One of the fun things about patrol is random patrol. And the more random but systematic you get, the better chance you are to be running into things. One of the worst things you can do is patrol your beat the same way every time. People sort of catch your patterns. But here's one tonight about one of the effects of climate change and what we found out now in a psychiatric journal. This is the Australian and New England Journal of Journal of Psychiatry. And the authors are Joshua Wolfe and Robert Sallow of the Melbourne Royal Children's Hospital, and they write this. We describe a patient with climate change delusion, a previously unreported phenomenon. Now, I don't know what it takes to get that officially recorded as some type of disorder, but they've already named it. And listen to the case of this young man, this character. A 17-year-old man was referred to the inpatient psychiatric unit at Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne with an 8-month history of depressed mood. He also had visions of apocalyptic events. The patient had also developed the belief that due to climate change, his own water consumption could lead within days to the deaths of millions of people through the exhaustion of the water supply in the world. He's quoted, incredible. The patient described that I feel guilty about it. Had attempted to stop drinking. He was unable to acknowledge that this belief was unreasonable when he was challenged by it. So he actually thought he was, in fact, doing good by drinking less water or no water. Now, I'd say that's a little bit over the edge, and we're going to see probably some more of this. You know, once there's a diagnosis, there'll be more diagnosis and prescriptions for care and people willing to provide that care, probably with some type. The next thing we'll see on television from the 5 to 7 o'clock hour is some type of drug. You know, see your doctor first, see what he or she says to stop this whole thing called, my gosh, climate change delusion. Very, very interesting. Well, Emily, you've got a story for us here tonight out of Romania, I think. And I think that's going to be sort of an interesting one to listen to. That's in my top three nations in the world in terms of interest. And what have you got? Oh, it's about stealing scrap metal. Okay, here we go. Let's see what this one sounds like then.
Scrap metal thief made off with 5 tons of metal from a steel plant after posing as fireman. The crooks had turned up at the middle steel plant outside Galati in eastern Romania in a fire engine, saying they had been told a blaze had broken out. But while some of the gang checked for signs of a fire, the rest loaded the truck with steel worth £15,000 on the scrap metal black market. They were foiled when police stopped their fire engine after a report that it had been stolen from the local fire brigade. Soaring metal prices, caused by demand in China and India, have led to a huge outbreak of scrap thefts all over Europe. In Britain this week, police launched a blitz on the crooks, who get rich from stealing lead from church roofs, railway tracks and cables, and even bronze statues.
Well, that's incredible. That city, by the way, it's on near the Black Sea. It's called Galați in eastern Romania. I've actually been there to do some recruiting here a number of years back. But that is just absolutely incredible that these thefts would be going on. I think we had a news story a few weeks ago where people were stealing from graves, and I guess that's becoming more and more common, the vases, the metal vases that set in front of graves or at grave sites, people were stealing it. The Cricks were kind enough not to steal, apparently, from the graves that had, or the vases that had flowers in them, but if they were empty, you were lucky, to keep your vase. Here's another one. This is what, out of Italy? Go ahead with this one. See what this says. Huh. You got it there? Okay. Go ahead.
An angry Italian was arrested for taking pot shots at his neighbor's unders with a rifle. Massimo Lazzaretti, 69, allegedly let fly with a legally owned hunting rifle he had at his home in Carnago after the 56-year-old woman had hung out her washing. A police spokesman said the two neighbors had fallen out some time ago, and he said he thought, by leaving bullet holes in her underwear, he would frighten her enough to stay away from them. He succeeded in frightening her, but only to the extent that she called up immediately. Lazzaretti has been charged with endangering public safety.
I think that's a pretty good charge for a guy like that. That's absolutely incredible. So I got a couple college and university stories here tonight, but I think I'm going to drop down here to one. Emily, if you don't mind, use that one that's talking about this very special place in North Carolina, where this High Point University is trying to present itself as the university that literally will serve you about anything that you want. Let's see if we can find that story in the stack. Have you got that yet, Emily? Absolutely incredible that this could go on. Here it is. You've got it. Okay. I've got it up on the screen. Go ahead and read this one, Emily. This is a college called High Point University, North Carolina, probably in High Point. And let's see if this is the university at your service.
Lots of colleges treat students like customers, but how many have an ice cream truck and valet parking and a concierge desk and an enormous hot tub in the middle of the campus? Not too many. Actually, only one High Point University. This one sleepy institution in the hills of North Carolina has undergone a revival in the last couple of years, thanks in part to its jaw-dropping menu of student services. Behind it all is High Point's president, Nidhar Mabeen, a motivational speaker and businessman who believes that the customer, that is, the student, should be not only satisfied, but wowed. To that end, he hired a director of WOW. The holder of that illustrious title is Roger D. Clogbooker, and it's his job to come up with ways to please current and prospective students. The ice cream truck that circles the campus doling out free frozen treats, more than 500 to choose from, is but one example. Another is live music in the cafeteria. One day might feature a folky guitar duo and the next a jazz quartet. When Mr. Corbin took over as president in 2005, he discovered that students spent an average of 12 minutes in the cafeteria per visit. It was not a destination point, he says. After the addition of live music and a bevy of flat-screen TVs, the average visit is 34 minutes. Near the entrance to the cafeteria is the concierge desk. The chief concierge, Leslie Smith, takes care of maintenance requests, gives restaurant recommendations, and sends out dry cleaning, among other services.
You have to be kidding me. They're sending out dry cleaning? How can that be? Go ahead.
Can also sign up for automated wake-up calls. Right now the voice is generic, but there is talk of adding a recording of the president himself urging students to get out of bed. Birthdays are big events at High Point. Each undergraduate, and there are 2,000, receives a birthday card from the university, signed by the president, with a Starbucks gift card tucked inside, plus balloons. What's more, when birthday boys and girls visit the cafeteria, their ID cards electronically alert the kitchen staff. The staff then fixes a slice of cake, and the featured musicians sing happy birthday.
How about that?
Employees aren't left out. They get a phone call from the president on their birthdays, all 551 of them. The list of frills goes on. Snack kiosks are located strategically around the campus, offering free bananas, pretzels, and drinks. Gifts await students in their dorms when they return from breaks. stats on top of the gifts they receive for no reason. The university keeps track of each student's preferences, movies, candy bars, sodas, etc., so all of them get exactly what they want. If it sounds like too much, well, maybe it is. But it's...
You have to be kidding me. I mean, what a place. And they have 551 students. I wonder how long they could keep that if they had 5,051. That would be interesting. What else you got to say about this?
In keeping with the president's philosophy, as summed up in the university's slogan at High Point, every student receives an extraordinary education in a fun environment with caring people. Mr. Quabeen, a High Point alumnus, came to the United States from Lebanon as a teenager. According to his up-by-the-bootstrap CEO, he had only $50 in his pocket. Now Mr. Quabeen, 59, is chairman of the board of the Great Harvest Bread Company, which has more than 200 stores. He's also written a shelf full of books with titles, like How to Get Anything You Want, and Close Like a Pro: Selling Strategies for Success. His strategy for High Point has so far been a success. Since Mr. Quabeen took over, freshman enrollment has tripled, even though the university is charging more. He's raised more than $100 million, mostly by tapping the wallets of wealthy friends. 7 buildings have been torn down, 12 new ones have been built, and 6 more are under construction. One of those new buildings, informally dubbed the Multiplex, will have a movie theater, a sports bar, and a steak house.
Wait a minute. This is turning out to be a city, isn't it?
Yes, a steak house. Students, not surprisingly, seem to love it. Some objected when trees were chopped down to make way for the rapid expansion. And some seniors and recent graduates complain that the new students are lazy and feel entitled. One possibly apocryphal story involves a freshman who opened his fridge for freshman accommodation for 2 person suites with kitchens and asked where's the food. Someone had to explain that he needed to purchase his own supplies. Faculty members seem to be mostly on board too. That may have something to do with the 2% bonuses they get at Thanksgiving, or their snazzy new office chairs. Also, according to several professors, many of the classrooms have been renovated, and departments now have more money for travel and research projects. Mr. Quabeen is acutely sensitive to the suggestion that High Point emphasizes good is over substance. Even the silliest seeming extra, he contends, has a larger purpose. When the students know you care, they reward you by doing well in the classroom, he says. Then they reward you by telling their friends, and by their parents becoming your donors. Other colleges are taking note. Mr. Quabeen says he receives inquiries from presidential search committees about once a month. And he says guys visit the campus regularly. Liberty University, in nearby Virginia, recently added its own ice cream truck during final exams. A Liberty official couldn't confirm that the idea came from High Point. Another way of making students happy is by beautifying the campus. 6 fountains have been added in the last 2 years, with 6 more on the way, along with numerous statues, including Atlas holding an enormous globe on the front lawn of the main administration building. On the promenade, unseen speakers play classical music throughout the day. Not everyone is thrilled to hear Brahms and Beethoven on the way to class, but the president thinks it is important to expose students to a little high culture. He does, however, make a concession to their musical taste. On the weekend, he says, we funk it up, chronicle.com.
Thank you, Emily. That's a very interesting story, and I remember once when I was up in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area on a consulting trip a number of years back that they started using classical music, symphony music on the square downtown to disperse the gangs. I think England has done something like that too, but I think they've now recently switched to this high-pitch sound that only young people can hear and adults can't, that sounds like mosquitoes, a pack of mosquitoes, and it runs them off. Very, very interesting. Let's see if the ice cream truck phase spreads or craze spreads across the country here in the United States. I'm not sure that's going to hit all of the campuses. For some reason, I can't see that at Ohio State or someplace like that. This is another one as part of the going green business. And California now has got a little plan for the new automobiles there. And Emily, why don't you go ahead and read us this one?
California is making it mandatory for cars to be labeled with global warming scores, figures that take into account emissions from vehicle use and fuel production. The law requiring the labels goes into effect at the start of next year for all 2009 model cars, though it's expected the labels will be popping up on cars in the coming months. The labeling law forces cars to fail to display a global warming score on a scale of 1 to 10, which is based on how vehicles in the same model year compare to one another. The higher the score, the cleaner a car is. The score takes into account emissions related to production of fuel for each vehicle as well as the direct emissions from vehicles.
Okay, what's that? That car that gets 10, is that one with a hole in the bottom for your leg and stick through? It runs like a scooter and gives very little emissions?
The score will be displayed next to the already required smog score, which also rates cars 1 to 10 for how many smog-forming emissions they emit. For both scores, an average vehicle will have a score of 5. California is the first state to pass such a law, and a similar law will take effect in New York for 2010 model year vehicles. Global warming scores will be included on the state's Drive Clean website. While this law is intended to help consumers take into account emissions while purchasing cars, a proposed law in the European Union would require any public sector body to put a price on emissions. A law endorsed by the European Parliament's Committee on Environment, Public Health and Food Safety would make governments put a monetary cost on the emissions of vehicles they plan to purchase, and add that to expense calculations. The law would exclude certain types of vehicles, such as ambulances and fire trucks.
Well, I think the only thing that is next is to put a label on people. Those that expel more air in. Breath into the air, of course, are adding to their carbon footprint. So absolutely incredible. I can't believe that something like that is going on. There's one last story in there I thought was interesting, if you can bear with us. It's one about police officers now are encouraging people to send text messages to report crimes. And I think, Emily, I'll let you read part of this. We may not go with the whole story because it's a long one, but go ahead and read a little bit of this for our listeners.
Police in the 1970s urged citizens to drop a dime and a payphone to report crimes anonymously. Now in an increasing number of cities, tipsters are being invited to use their thumbs to identify criminals using text messages. Police hope the idea helps recruit teens and 20-somethings who wouldn't normally dial a Crime Stoppers hotline to share information with authorities. If somebody hears Johnny is going to bring a gun to school, hopefully they'll text that in, said Sergeant Brian Bernardi of Allowanceville, Sky, Metro Police Department, which rolled out its text message tip line in June. Departments in Boston and Cincinnati started accepting anonymous text tips about a year ago. Since then, more than 100 communities have taken similar steps or plan to do so. The internet-based systems route messages through a server that encrypts cell phone numbers before they get to police, making tips virtually impossible to track. In Lowestown earlier this week, Bernard's computer displayed a text message from a person identified only as tip 563. It reads, "Someone has vandalized the school van at Fowler School on Bardstown Road in Fern Creek."
Well, the story goes on, Emily, and thank you for reading that. It said here, Boston, in a year's time, logged 678 tips, nearly matching the 727 phone tips during that same period of time. So maybe there's something to this. It certainly must be generational. I have all kinds of ways to use the internet, cell phones, email, wireless, from about anywhere you can think. But I've never sent a text message in my life, and I don't intend to. So there's a first for everything, but that one's not going to be one of mine. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think what we'll do is just go ahead and move. I was going to look at some articles here in American Police Beat magazine. I don't know if you ever see that, but it's a really nice, not only pictorial display of some news stories and some exotic advertising in it also, but it's a very nice down-to-earth reporting of what happens to cops on the beat in the United States. And there's some good stories in there, each issue. And if there was a quote in here I thought was interesting. I'm not sure exactly how it ties in with policing, but they have it in there. And the little blue panels fading into white, they have some quotes in each issue. And here's one by Harry Truman. He says, "My choice early in life was either to be a piano player in a whorehouse or a politician. And to tell you the truth," he says, "there's hardly any difference." That was our president of the United States, Harry Truman. So, ladies and gentlemen, one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight, or our topic for tonight, is this whole business of what's happening to the published world, publishing world in the field of criminal justice and publishing in general. And I'm no expert on the publishing field, but I've delivered a book and unsold most of them. I've delivered a book in just about every version you can, and most of you who have listened to the show before know that I plan on taking 25, maybe 30 of the best of our blog talk, not the best, but significant blog talk radio guests, and the book's going to be called Criminal Justice Heroes and Heroines, and what we're going to do is put them in the book. I can tell you people like Karen Munch, who's the head of the watercraft training for the state of Ohio, for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. We'll probably have Marshal Al Smith in there, and on and on and on. Crime analyst and crime analyst leader Mark Stallo. And I'm not doing justice to many of these people who are going to be in the book, so I'm not going to mention them. But audio books are becoming more and more popular. I've known they've been around a long time. I've listened to them through audible.com and that thing, but I've just started to buy audio books, and I'm starting to enjoy them. But having a book published is a very special event. I wrote about this in a paper article I wrote years ago, not that many years ago, in 2006, called Books, Bites, and Bragging Rights. And it was an analysis of criminal justice publishers and their products. And to have a book published, I did my first one back in 1977. And it's a self-published book, and it's sort of a long story, but I'll give you this short version. And since then, periodically, I've counting new editions and all sorts of things. I'm up to about 20, maybe even 21 books, and I'm working on a couple right now. I've had long books, I've had short books, I've had books published by major publishers. I guess McGraw Hill claims, or people tell me, they're still the largest publisher in the world, so I have a co-authored book that way on Introduction to Criminal Justice with Bob Bohm. And then I have self-published books and digital books, and I have a couple books now on Kindle, Amazon's new reading device that takes publishing right now. You could be writing a book and publish it on Kindle tonight at no cost. And we'll have more to say about the Kindle and the Sony Reader tonight. But anyway, when you produce a work like this, it's not so much the exhilaration that comes from saying it's done. I think it's a recognition to me that you have, in fact, written it. I mean, there's a joy in writing it, although it's labor, and you have to stay on it, and many people start books and don't finish them till years later, if they finish them at all. But depending on the size, nature, complexity of the book, no matter what that is, it's interesting to do. And in this paper, I talked about how one of my friends was looking for a new frontline type of book. It's Professor Mark Stallo on something in crime analysis, and so he decided there was nothing around on how to use Microsoft Office products in the crime analysis function and processes. So he did that on his own, and he tried a couple different kind of publishers, and he finally ended up going with BookSurge, which is a very fine publishing unit now. And if you've been following the news about digital publishing and publishing in general, you probably realize that Amazon has purchased BookSurge, and it is another publishing arm of the great Amazon company. And, you know, if you looked at Amazon lately, I think you'll see that Amazon, you can buy anything from them, including automobiles, washing machines, books, et cetera. So what happened back to me back in 1976 with professor and continuing education assistant director Jim Vondrell at the University of Cincinnati, we tried to get a book published on memory skills. We had a very successful memory skills seminar that we had done various places around the region here in the Midwest and also across the nation. And we wanted a book because students kept asking us for notes and notes and notes and notes. And we finally said, well, we'll come up with a book. So one of my students, who was actually an editor for, I won't call out the publisher, he actually said, well, yeah, send it into our company and we'll see what they can do. Well, this is the first time I'd ever done that. I just sort of started my academic career. So I sent in this book manuscript and wait and wait and wait. There's a little agonizing over that until you hear. And they came back and said that they didn't think the book was worthy of publishing in their particular market. Now, I can tell you that my ego was not shattered. So, but I was motivated to decide, why don't I go publish the book myself? So in the next 6 months, we took off and interviewed many people in terms of printers. You need a printer, and you need a binder. This book was perfect bound. And we went around and auditioned with, or had them audition three or four of what they could do for us. And we finally chose one who didn't do perhaps the best job, but he gave us a fine book. And the net result of that was we sold over the next, I'm guessing, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. No, it wasn't that long, 3 years. We sold nearly 2,000 copies of the book in 13 nations. Now, we did that with great difficulty because, a publisher provides you a number of services. One, they provide you editorial review, and they provide you printing service and binding service, storage service, sales service, and distribution services. Well, when you publish your own book, other than the printing and the binding, you're the rest of all those services. So it takes a lot of time, but we had fun doing it. In fact, I'm going to do an update on that book now. And then the idea of self-publishing, there's a couple of things involved here for academics as I talk to them over the years. And one of the things is they say, well, first of all, they don't know a lot on how to do this, and they still don't. I'm going to step out and say that. They're sort of mystified about self-publishing. And I remind them that people like William Strunk Jr., 1918, his great book, Elements of Style, how many zillion copies of that have been sold? And I'll talk to you more about the millionaires list of publishers, self-publishers. He published Elements of Style for about 6 years before he actually sent it to a publisher. And that's certainly one of the most certainly published books in the world. So it's an interesting process. And what my friend Mark Stallow did, he finally decided that he would go to a print-on-demand publisher. That one didn't work out very well, so he finally ended up, a serendipitous sort of route. He ended up with BookSearch, which was later bought by Amazon. Of course, if you go to Amazon.com, put in Mark Stallow, you can see Microsoft applications in Prime Analysis or a title, something like that. So, and then when you get with Amazon, you've taken care of your book distribution, and in some ways you're advertising, because when people browse around Amazon.com, a number of books come up. And they also have a separate book search function now for the Kindle, and I'll have more to say about the Kindle here in a moment. So in this university business, where at least it used to be sort of publish and perish, there's sort of a quandary. And one of the quandaries is, okay, this guy can publish or this woman can publish this perhaps finest book ever written in the field, but if they self-publish it and they don't have editorial review, you know what that means. That means, well, they send it out to experts. I've got a book where fifth edition and co-authored, and the book is sent out to people to review, and I certainly over the years have done that many times for others. In other words, you don't get the editorial review, which is supposed to provide you the critique and quality enhancement through doing that. But when you self-publish, of course, you are the, unless you send it out to people yourself, you're the editorial review board, so to speak. And the academic world doesn't know how to handle this. They say, well, it hasn't gone through editorial review. Now, I don't know how long you've been in academia or whether you hang around it at all, but sometimes that editorial review means, are my friends on the editorial review board for a journal or hired specially for a book to be an editorial director for a particular series of books. So sometimes, you know, knowing someone gets you in the right stead. So that's going on too. They don't know what to do about this editorial review business for self-published books. But I say just forge right on through that. And I never criticize anybody's book. I really don't. I say at least they wrote one. And I hear all sorts of people talking over the years about, yeah, his book is not this, it's not that. And sometimes I ask them, or at least I know, and I see they haven't published any. So, you know, it's their turn. Let's throw theirs out there and see what other people say about that. So this publishing on demand is certainly an interesting type of idea. And then, again, in some of these sites, you can literally get this book out in no time. You know, there's a book market site on the Internet actually maintains a self-publisher's Hall of Fame. And this includes such names as Scott Adams, the creator of the Dilbert comic strip, and Ken Blanchard and Spencer Johnson, who wrote the famous book, The One-Minute Manager, that took about 4 minutes to read. You could read it at the bookshelf in the bookstore. But it sold 12 million copies in 25 different languages as a self-published book. Do you think those folks didn't make a pretty good dollar on that? And did they care if somebody at a publisher gave them editorial review? I'm sure they didn't. So in many ways, this self-publishing is sort of bucking the trend. But it's like anything. You have big dogs and little dogs, and sometimes those little dogs grow up, and a good book I think will be discovered. I've always said that. I can remember Frank Day sitting under him at Michigan State University. He was co-author of German Day and Galati's Introduction to Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice, the first intro to CJ book that came out in the late 60s or maybe 1970. And he said, you know, the money you make from this is almost nothing. At that time, he made a few thousand dollars a year as a co-author with that book. Of course, you'd probably make more and something like that now. You know, that's another little thing that's kind of interesting. And when you are an author and you use books for your own course, your own books for your own course, you've got some people that come in and say, well, you know, you're only using your own book to make money. And I solved that problem a long time ago. I don't take any money. Make sure that that's not worked. In fact, I taught at a college in Texas that wouldn't allow you. You actually, when you used your own book, which I used in the intro to CJ book, I had to actually get a statement from the publisher and have it on record that I was making no royalties from a book on that. But I do that anyway. There's a lot of things you can do with these type of books, and the same type of thing has hit the magazine and the journal business. You know, if you look at some of these fine journals online, some of them have editorial review, some of them don't. There's very good. There's a very fine British journal called Surveillance and Society. And to have this now available to you, all these articles, both archived and the current issue articles available on the web, is just an incredible thing for both students and faculty who would have a particular interest in that. Some of the most available self-publishing companies now, if people would be interested, are Lulu. .com, that's Lulu.com, is a very interesting site, and they make a nice, attractive book, and their software is very easy to work with. I can tell you from working with some other folks, I'm not going to call them out, some other publishers, where you submit the book, their software has not been easy. But with Lulu, it's very amenable software to work with. They have some literally hundreds of nice covers to choose from, so that's a good one. With several graduate students here a year and a half ago, we published a book, maybe 2 years now, we published a book called Strange But Real. In fact, we have the authors on the radio show. Perspectives on Odd Issues in Criminal Justice was the subtitle. And the book looked very nice, and it also is in digital form. So when you buy a book in digital form, I guess you're paying attention to these prices. These prices are down to almost nothing compared to some other, you know, a hardback or even a paperback book. If a book's running like $22 or $23, $16 or $17. You can often pick that up in a digital copy for something like $7 or $8 or even less. So it's a good deal that way. You also know, or perhaps don't know, that if you're teaching a course and you want a collection of articles, you can now go to publishers like McGraw-Hill or some of the other Pearson, some of the other large companies, and you can pick from content that they already have the copyright to, and you can assemble your own book. And sometimes they'll let you submit your own original two or three articles or something like that. That goes into a book with your name, a book of edited readings, with an introduction, and it fits perfectly for your course. There was an article today in one of the higher education magazines that has a daily reporting, and it talked about how these books are better serving faculty and courses now because they can put these course pack books together, and it will fit perfectly. Now, most of you have used Adobe Acrobat, and you realize a PDF format, if you got a manual on Adobe or you're familiar with it, you know that there's a chapter or section in there on how to make an ebook. So you can make an electronic book, protect it so that it can't be copied, and you can actually do that through Adobe, and there you are. That could be your first book. I think most folks realize too that the net is changing. We have lots of text, and perhaps every newspaper in the world is on the internet, and then some. And printed papers, some of these are laying off, reporters and staff at an unprecedented rate, and it looks like that trend isn't going to be turned around. And part of that is because people are just simply reading the news on the internet. And if you take some fine newspapers, something like the International Herald Tribune, I love to read that on the airplane if I'm traveling overseas. It literally covers news all over the world. Now you don't even have to read the articles on your computer. You can actually listen to one. I'm going to give you an example of that. I'm going to play it here for you. Not the whole article, just give you an example. This is an article about how the U.S. Senate confirms Petraeus for the Middle East Command, and it's in the International Herald Tribune.
U.S. Senate confirms Petraeus for Middle East Command. Reuters. Thursday, July 10, 2008. Washington. The U.S. Senate on Thursday overwhelmingly confirmed General David Petraeus as commander of the military headquarters responsible for U.S. operations across the Middle East, including Iraq and Afghanistan. The Senate confirmed him by a vote of 95-2.
Okay, you get the picture. The Washington Times has completely changed their site now, and you can do literally podcast every article. They, for I guess almost 2 years now, or maybe even more, they've had the ability for you to click on listen to the article. So the idea of picking up a hard copy of newspaper books and that type of thing, people love books. I love them myself. There's something about holding a book that really works. And the book was a great invention. It was compact. It could be carried anywhere. Some of them literally last for centuries. So we don't want to negate the value of the book. And I'm not sure we're ever going to see it go down the wayside or go to the wayside. But we do now have things that have replaced that. And I own one of those. And I think two of the best electronic readers that you can get nowadays, many people have tried these, but both of these work out in bright sunlight. You turn it on at high noon and the brightest sun you can have, and you can read it just like you're standing there reading a book. Of course, you can't do that with a computer or a PDA or a small computer or something like that. And one is the Amazon's Kindle. It costs about $400, $399. And the Kindle actually gives you a direct link without any type of subscription, where you can get on the internet and download a book to their sites. It's not a full web browser, but you can download any of the Kindle books down onto your Kindle, which costs about $3.99. It's about the size of a good sized paperback book, and it will download just in a few minutes, and you can away you go reading. And these books, the Kindle I think holds, don't quote me, maybe depending on the size of the book, maybe 80 or 90 or 100 books. The Kindle also plugs into major newspapers. For example, the New York Times would be one of those. I have the Sony Reader. It's the number one. It was first, and it's a big competitor with the Kindle. It doesn't. You have to connect to the internet to download the books, but it's real easy. They also give you 100 free books when you buy one. It's only $2.99. It looks to me a little bit more durable, and I've talked to a couple people that have Kindles, and that internet connection doesn't work everywhere anyway. So, plus, what's the hurry of downloading the book? I mean, I can figure out I want the book, and I don't need it like in the next 2 seconds, so I can hook it up by cable to my computer, and away I go. But my Sony, I think I've got 7 or 8 books on it right now. And, again, out in the bright sun, for $2.99, this thing reads just like your, or looks just exactly like you're reading a book in the same location. And the Kindle only, or the Sony Reader that I have only needs recharge every 7,000 page turns. Isn't that incredible? So it's a low energy device. So people can appreciate it for that reason. So this, I think, is what the world is coming to in terms of books. And now, if you go to something like those of you who work in Ohio or have access to ohiolink.edu, OhioLink here in the last year has added e-books. So you can actually go right on the website, ohiolink.edu, go down to the left column and click on e-books, and you come up with a search page, and it literally says we have thousands and thousands of e-books that are available to students generally at no cost. And these books are incredible. You can type in a term like police and you'll come back. I did that today just thinking about our show tonight. And when I did it, I came back. There was one on criminal profiling, which is a very popular subject. And there's an introduction to law enforcement and on and on. Just about many, many titles that you would think of are available there in e-book form. And students can download them to the computer. They can download many of these things now to iPods. I have an iPod, and it's a very useful device. It's essentially the same thing as the iPhone without the phone capability. It has a Safari browser, which is a real sophisticated PDA type of browser, and it works very well. So. Libraries now, of course, on ohiolink.edu, it also links you to 4, 5, 6 other sources that also have e-books available. Now you can go to many of these bookstores and download e-books. You can go to various places on the internet and find these electronic books too. So these, of course, for the student, what's happening here is the cost can go down to zero. Or at least even if they have to buy one, it's going to be a minimal charge compared to something like Introduction to Criminal Justice that might be $120, $119, $125, or something like that. And there are books you get into some other fields. I don't know what they're doing, but medical books and law books and things like that are often $200, $300, $400, $500, some even $500 in for medical school books. So I think the potential here, this Kindle and the Sony e-reader, is going to kick off a big consumer interest and student interest, faculty interest in digital books, and that is going to generate faculty interest, I think, in the self-publishing business where these books can in fact be read, downloaded, stored on the part of students and other faculty and other scholars in their field. So it's wide open, and I could talk forever about this subject, and I've probably hurried a little bit tonight, but if you're interested in it, give me a buzz or give me a call in the office, and we can talk about it. So in the meantime, I think it's just about time to sign off, but I was going to do one more little story here that I thought was interesting. And this is out of Chicago, and it says, a news story, it says that Chicago police detectives who are not assigned to the FBI's Violent Crimes Task Force will no longer respond to bank robberies in Chicago. Now, I probably need to know more about this, but isn't that odd? It says the new boss, Jody Weiss, says the FBI will now handle bank robberies in the Windy City. Needless to say, the change in policy has raised a few eyebrows and created tremendous concern among the rank and file of the police. And the FOP president there, Mark Donohue, said morale is already at a very low point and it won't get any better if career FBI agents end up being the only ones that are going to be investigating bank robberies. But doesn't that sound a little odd? They're going to handle all those duties. Our members are a little confused by what message is being sent. What's the reason for it, he says. These are our jobs. We're cutting back on our responsibilities, Donohue, the FOP president, says. Bank robbery is a federal offense, Donohue continued, but our guys are the ones who work it. A concern has been brought forth from our membership that this could potentially happen in other areas in the future. And I think the strange thing here is, why would the FBI be pushing this themselves? I don't get this. I'm going to have to follow up and find out more about it. But does that mean when a bank alarm goes down, the Chicago police don't respond? And they're going to depend on the FBI to do that? It's going to be interesting to see what happens with something like that. So I'm not sure that seems like it's a very good idea, but we'll have to see what happens. There's another article in here before we sign off tonight about pregnant cops face one tough choice. What's happening now, based on all the gear that officers have to wear in all this business, woman officers could work pretty much up close to the time they were having a child, maybe the first 6 months at least. But now some of these police chiefs around the country are saying, well, you can't work duty anymore because of all the gear you have to carry in. He says, due to the heavy physical demands of the job with bulletproof vests and 15 to 20 pounds of equipment officers carry around their waist, female officers know that to admit to being pregnant essentially means losing their income. Isn't that interesting? We'll have to see more what comes out of something like that. But I would think that, they could work. Many of them have worked right up close to the time, and we'll have to see how that's going to be handled by police chiefs and policymakers across the nation. Well, Audrey's kind of giving me a signal there tonight about it's time to sort of sign off, and I hope you enjoyed this little bit of mumbling about the publishing and self-publishing business. And again, if you have any questions about that, you be sure and let me know, and I'll be glad to try to assist you in answering those questions. It's a fascinating business. I don't think anybody knows all the answers at any given point in time, but we're going to hear a lot more about digital and self-publishing and audio books. Okay, Audrey, I got it. Okay, good night, folks. I'm sure we'll be meeting again.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Just like you always do, till the blue sky drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. Again, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.